you hear these stories, you meet these people, and you realize that human beings are actually pretty wonderful. I mean, we're all so complicated, and there is nastiness out there. But the stories that are not being told are the stories of how wonderful we are.
This episode is brought to you by WeWork. Being able to work remotely is a game changer. You know, you don't have to spend time and money commuting, and often you can just work from anywhere in the world. But it does have its downsides too. You know, it can get pretty lonely working from home. And if you're off traveling, it can get really hard to find somewhere to sit down and work that's quiet and doesn't have sticky tables. That's where WeWork comes in. WeWork is a co-working space with offices all over the world. They have everything you need. Fast Wi-Fi, free tea and coffee, tons of desk space and meeting rooms, so that you always have somewhere to go to get your work done, whether that's alone or with friends and coworkers. And with WeWork On Demand, you can book co-working space by the day and meeting rooms by the hour at locations wherever you need. To get a great deal from my friends at WeWork, just go to my special link, we.co/Brian50. That's we.co/BRYAN50. Download the WeWork app and enter this code to get 50% off your next booking.
I'm Chris Anderson, and you're on Behind the Brand with Brian Elliott.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the series. Chris, welcome.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here with all these fine people.
Let's have another little round of applause. All right. And then just housekeeping, I would really like to thank our host WeWork for having us today. I've been a WeWork partner since like 2012. I love it here. They took good care of me. I'm based in Los Angeles. I have a little office in West Hollywood, which we converted into a studio. And it's where we do a lot of our podcasts. Of course, we do shoot on location sometimes. But welcome. If this is your first time to WeWork, if you're a member here, I'm sure you feel right at home. So we're talking about your book, Infectious Generosity. I read the book. I love it. It resonates with me. And I think it's a pattern that you've established for a long time. I had a really good experience the other day with generosity, but I want to dig into the book and I want to talk about some of the themes. The first thing I want to ask you, I guess, is what have you seen recently that's given you hope?
I had a conversation with a 20-something-year-old, I'm going to guess 22-year-old, a TikTok influencer, actually. But before that, he was a kid working in a sandwich shop. His parents were immigrants. And he was on TikTok and saw these videos out there of this trend of people just dumping food, like huge amounts of food waste, just because it was fun to kind of destroy your parents' kitchen, like peanut butter everywhere. He was disgusted by this. So he thought, I'm going to make my own video. So he made a video, huge amounts of peanut butter, huge amounts of peanut butter, huge amounts of jelly, made up 100 sandwiches, wrapped them individually, took them out onto the street, gave them to people who looked like they could use a sandwich. And his video got way, way more views than the trend that he was overcoming. And when I spoke to him, he was so sophisticated about in how he was thinking about this. So he'd been inspired by Mr. Beast, who many of you all know is the lead influencer on YouTube, partly through generosity videos, wild, wacky, incredible generosity videos. He was saying, look, anything can go viral today that provokes emotion. It's easy to slap someone in the face on video. That will go viral. But it's not symmetric. If you do good things, they get remembered longer. They can build into something that actually matters. Yeah. And so it's a question my generation asks you. It's like, do you want to be a dick for a day or do you want to do something that matters? He made me so damn hopeful because I don't know about you, my generation, the people I talk to a lot of the time have given up on the modern era. You know, we're so depressed and we have many reasons to be like that. You know, the internet is this outrage machine. It's spreading toxicity. There are people out there who believe that we can win this battle and actually that there is a way of spreading goodness that will actually win the day at the end of the day. I found him hugely inspiring.
Amazing. So this series is called Behind the Brand. And let's go back in the chronology a little bit. People don't know that you had this whole life and career before TED. Talk about that journey, like what you did to make your money. I know that you talk about in the book about the dot-com bust and all that, but let's go way back in the chronology.
Okay.
To younger Chris.
Younger Chris, the entrepreneur. I'm passionate about entrepreneurs, and I'm biased because I was one. I wasn't originally. I was born in Pakistan, missionary parents, grew up early years, Pakistan, India, Afghanistan, went to a global school with kids from 30 countries, loved it. But eventually, a few years later, ended up in UK as a journalist, and then fell in love with computers. And there was a moment when I didn't know at the time how lucky my timing was, but computers were making it suddenly much lower cost to produce a magazine. Instead of these big London-based production houses, big unions and all the rest of it, you could do it with just a small group of people with computers, computer typesetting. So I started a computer magazine. The company was called Future Publishing. And I didn't know how incredible it was that I was able, and anyone in this space could have done this at the time. In that business, it was possible to grow a company through its own cash flow because you could get paid by the distributor just before the printer bills were due. So if you got it right, you could launch a magazine. If you were quick in the launch, you know, like 3 months from idea to launch, you could launch an indefinite number of magazines and they would all grow the business. So this business grew from one magazine very quickly to about 30 or 40, doubled every year for 7 years. Mm-hmm. I had no outside shareholders, and I kind of couldn't believe what was happening.
How many on your team at the time?
I mean, at that time, I want to say there was about 130 or 150 on the team. I came to the US to try and do the same, much harder here, it turned out, but eventually it took off. There were a bunch of computer magazines like Mac Addict, you might have seen, or PC Gamer. The one that got most attention was Business 2.0, which in the early days of the internet suddenly got very fat before it blew up. Come the dawn of the millennium, I thought I was this very cool, successful media publisher. I had 2,000 people working, and it was now a public company in the UK.
Yeah.
And there were 150 monthly magazines and a bunch of websites, and life was great. And I was a rock star until I wasn't.
Yeah. And give us an idea of context. Like, what was the gross revenue? Like, what kind of peaks did you hit?
At the peak, it was probably about 200 or 300 million UK pounds. I'm blotting out some of these numbers because they did go down very fast for a bit.
Yeah.
So whatever, $400 million.
Yeah.
And at its peak, the company was valued at a couple of billion dollars, whatever.
I mean, incredible.
Know, for a day and a half. And then the dot-com crash hit. And because most of our magazines were in technology and we had a couple of issues internally, boom, you know, we it was so damn painful. I would go onto fuckedcompany.com, which was chronicling the disastrous fall of all these companies, just to see if by any chance any one of my employees had written anything nice about me at all. Never happened. We had to fire 350 people in a day, 1,000 people overall. It was gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
And so I had this incredible good fortune to be able to make a sideways move. I mean, we sold Business 2.0 to Time Warner. Future, therefore, was able to pay off its debt and survive. And it's still thriving pretty well right now, actually.
Yeah.
I couldn't manage that process. But I had a chance to buy TED. And so I did. And I didn't buy it with personal money because it had all gone. But I had set up a foundation a few years earlier, when times were better. And it was that foundation that bought TED. And this turned out to be the most serendipitous thing for multiple reasons. Not just that TED was so fun after years of just battling with public markets and so many employees and all the rest of it. To get to hang out with some of the coolest thinkers in the world, that was pretty neat. Mm-hmm. But the biggest single thing was that, in part because TED was owned by a nonprofit, we were pushed to do what was I think if we'd been a company, it would have still been the wise and smart thing to do, but I'm not sure that we'd have done it as a company. Mm-hmm. And it was to adopt a strategy of radical generosity. And that actually has seeded all that I've written about here.
I love that. So, the context to me is really relevant. The people who listen to this podcast, who are in this room, they're all probably running their own businesses. You know, it's a solopreneurship, you know, of one, or it could be a company of 50. But each of us is running our own businesses. So to have that context, and I think, you know, a friend of mine, Gary Vee, once told me very famously, you can't fake being good at push-ups. You're either good at them or not. And the only way to get good at push-ups is just to do them, right? And so businesses, I think, is the same way. It's like, for better or for worse, the only way to get experience is to go through hell and back several times. And sometimes, you know, you have good fortune and you and invent a website called Facebook and it does extremely well and never looks back. Or you have businesses like ours and, you know, there's twists and turns. But it's all this experience that we gain, which then we can take with us and roll into the next endeavor. So you bought TED. Was this 98?
There was a bit of a 98 was when I first went to TED. I actually bought it with the foundation in 2001, end of 2001.
Okay. I mean, another year that a lot is happening, right? This is the year of 9/11. This is when the world is turned upside down. A volatile year, to say the least. Mm. And, you know, the internet's still a baby at that point, right? Like, you know, 1997, 1998. I mean, I don't know what population of the world had a website, but it's like, It was just crawling out of the crib.
There was no online video, of course, back then.
Yeah.
The TED I bought was an annual conference, technology, entertainment, design, three industries coming together, 500 people, you know, but everyone still got inspired and loved it. And it felt like there was something amazing there, but it was niche and it was lovely, but it was niche.
So tell that story of how you published the first kind of videos and what happened.
Yeah, so as a nonprofit, we had a duty to try and somehow let the magic that was at TED out into the world. And we weren't very good at discovering how to do that. I tried knocking on the doors of some TV companies, and they're like, let me get this right. You want to put public lectures on television, people talking about difficult subjects. You know that is really boring, right? Anyway, so we were unsuccessful, but then on came online video. Initially, you know, a little square of jerky pixels in the corner of your screen, but it was there. And so we did an experiment with six talks from one conference in 2006, not really thinking that we thought that they might get some views, but we didn't think that people would really be moved by them because pixels in a screen. You know, as opposed to a human being in a room. Turns out human beings are really, really, really inspiring on video, even, you know, low bandwidth video.
Yeah.
And we got incredible responses from that experiment. And that gave us this dilemma. What do we do? Because it felt like the right thing to do was to give away all of our good content at this point and just share it. And the fear was that would kill the conference. The conference was expensive. Why would you go to an expensive conference if all the content was available for free to any Joe Schmo? We did it. Brave people with me at the time and the sort of nagging feeling that we had to do it. And it turned out to be the best thing ever because it spread TED's reputation around the world. Demand for the conference went up and everything followed. And it was that convinced us that there is a strategy here. All these people, you know, people who come to TED and say, oh, the internet's different, you know, information wants to be free, all this stuff. I hadn't really felt it until I'd done it. Mm-hmm. And then it really felt there is a strategy of radical generosity that could change everything. And we applied it to our brand. And that was a bigger risk still, I would say.
I want to learn more or understand more about the behind the scenes. So was there like a serious discussion? Because I can, you know, I'm sure each of us in here has thought, you know, gosh, I've got this great idea. I don't want to share it. You know, I haven't trademarked it. I haven't copyrighted it. Like, what if someone steals my great idea? I want to keep it, you know, secret. I don't want to share it. Was there a strategic like debate? Like, this is a terrible idea, Chris, or?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Ideas are so interesting, right? Like, as Thomas Jefferson said, you know, I can give away my ideas. It's like if I share the light of my taper with someone else, my taper is still a light. My candle is still a light. That's true. And so that's why giving of non-material things is possible at scale. But you are giving up something. You're giving up exclusivity. You're giving up, you're allowing anyone else to exploit it. Yeah. And so that can definitely make it a real challenge as to whether to do that. So there was a debate. In our case, it was that we're giving up, that potentially conference revenue.
And you thought it was going to cannibalize.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I think a lot of people haven't fully hit them just how many things have connected in the internet age. One, the value of non-material things is going up the whole time. If you measure value by where people spend their time and you look at how you spend your time in a day, almost everything you're doing is really powered by something non-material. You're reading something, or it's software, or it's video, or that is what matters to us as creative human souls, and all of that stuff can be given away online. Second, whereas 20 years ago, like for me to give away non-material content would mean burning onto a DVD and mailing it out $2 a time. That does not scale very fast. Or very, very far.
Yeah.
Now it's free, and this is astonishing. Like the cost of distributing digital content because of the internet has fallen by 6 or 7 orders of magnitude. I mean that it's Moore's law. Forget it. This is Moore's law multiplied 1,000 times. It's incredible, that shift. So right there, let's see. It's easy to give away something really valuable to limitless numbers of people for free. Holy cow.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? Every one of those gifts carries with it the most important reputation of our age, reputation. So when you put those three things together, I think the rules have changed radically about how we think about what we hold on to. Because it's true that you give up exclusivity, but you also have a shot at attracting a tribe of people who want to engage with you, who will surprise you with what they give back. One of the other riddles of this that is profound is that if people perceive as what they get as given in a generous spirit, they will respond with generosity of their own. We gave away our content. Thousands of translators came to us and said, we would love to translate this into our language for free. So that was incredible. What you can get back is astonishing. And in our case, we got back the biggest single thing, which was a platform, a flywheel, which obviously in the online age is counts for so much. But anyway, I just think the rules have changed, and that at a minimum, it's worth any organization, as well as any individual, taking a half day or a day to brainstorm. What's the scariest thing we could give away? What's the most radical? What's the best asset we have that imaginably we could give away? Can we construct an argument for how to do that in a way that could be smart?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I, in the last 5 years, I've seen a lot of the publishers go to a paywall. Wall Street Journal, all the best publishers have put a wall, high wall up their content. And I wonder how that's impacting their business. If you're printing the Wall Street Journal still, I don't know what the circulation is these days. Is it 1 million? But online, I would assume, is 10 to 20 times that. And yet they have the paywall up. I wonder if that's driving.
It's definitely limited their influence.
Yeah.
The readership of the New York Times or the Guardian or whatever is vastly higher than the Wall Street Journal at this point because of that paywall. I mean, the New York Times is one of the few that have made a success of subscription model. The Guardian's gone a different route of giving away its content and inviting people to be generous back to them, which is interesting. And in their own terms, that they're pretty successful as well. I'm not saying be stupid. it's like it needs to be thought about. When we gave away our brand, we thought long and hard about it. So we offered a free license to people around the world to put on their own TED events,
yeah.
But they had to put the X label on it. The X initially stood for, locally organized. TEDx New York is TED locally organized here. But the X came to me and sort of raised to the exponential power, because what happened was that we ended up with like 3,000 volunteer teams around the world putting on events for us at their own financial risk, using their own time. I mean, it was incredible. So we didn't control it, and things could go wrong and occasionally did. But what was amazing was that the vast majority of time, people were obsessed with trying to do this the best they possibly could. We had rules and we had tools, and both of those are incredibly important. The tools are probably even more important than the rules. The rules were that you had to do it in a certain way. You had to respect the format, and you know, you couldn't engage, you know, like
sell tickets.
You could sell tickets, but not to cover costs,
right.
Basically. You couldn't, you know, there were limits on like politics, religion, pseudoscience. No, thank you. But what happened was incredible, was that they learned from each other. They learned themselves. And these events just took off. They are responsible for many of the best TED speakers. Simon Sinek, who some of you may have seen, thank you, is filmed at a TEDx event with a little shaky camera.
Yeah, it's didn't the worst matter. Production it's the quality
worst
ever.
Production quality, yeah. Incredible talk. And it's been seen
failed,
by,
yeah.
What, 40, 50 million people?
Yeah.
And so when you think about just the economics of this, I mean, again, just it staggers me, this. So I've got 200 people overall. The team overlooking TEDx is 10 people, 10 full-time employees. So they are running a media business that is putting on 3,000 global events annually. It's generating 25,000 videos that go up on YouTube. They're generating a billion views annually. I mean, you could not do that. There's no way on God's earth you could do that except through radical generosity. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I think there's a big deal here that is worth exploring more broadly. And many people are doing it and are doing incredible things. But it's beautiful. And it's been, even though the potential has been there for a long time, I just don't think we've fully explored the potential yet.
Let's stay on brand for a second. How do you look at brand and brand building? And then, you know, what is the Chris Anderson brand? And then maybe, you know, how is that different from the TED brand?
Huh. So I'll confess to you that part of me doesn't like the word brand at all. Like I don't, because sometimes it means I'm going to market something to you that is better than the thing itself. My brand will seduce you into spending money that you shouldn't spend, you know? So for me, what you want a brand to be is just the label that is put on a product or a collection of products that people love. They love it for a reason, and the brand stands for that love.
Yeah.
I don't use the word that much for TED. I mean, I just did use it. I say just in the sake, because you know, we gave it away, but perhaps that's why we gave it away, because I don't like the word.
Yeah.
I like what it stands for. I like ideas. I like the sharing of ideas. And as for me, I don't think I have a brand. I think of myself as a dreamer first and foremost. Like I'm not a great business manager in many circumstances, but I do dream. I have big dreams, and occasionally, most of them are mad. And occasionally, though, like dreaming in the sense of dot connecting. You know, I'm worried about this thing here. I'm excited about that thing there. I just learned about this thing here. I'm awake at 3 o'clock in the morning. Wait a sec. You could connect those three things, and out pops a possibility. That is exciting. So that's when I feel most alive.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But I'm also socially awkward, introverted, and I forget everyone's name, which is a terrible thing. I'm really very, very broken and wonky in many ways. But I do like to dream.
Well, that's relatable. I'm also awkward and introverted. I'm going to push back a little bit on the brand, because you know, I think personal branding is important. And if I'm thinking back to a talk I had with our mutual friend Seth Godin, Seth also said, "I reject that label. I'm not a brand. I'm a human being," in typical Seth fashion. But I think you know the other thing he told me is like, you know, a brand is a shorthand for what you stand for. He said, you know, close your eyes and try to imagine if Nike built a hotel. You know, can you picture what that might look like? or feel like or smell like or the kind of experience you'd have there at the Nike Hotel that doesn't exist. But like, if you can imagine that, you can probably come up with something, right? You know, there's something tangible there in your imagination. And that's because Nike has a brand.
Yeah.
If, you know, Hyatt came out with a pair of shoes, that's a little bit more difficult to imagine what a Hyatt pair of sneakers would look like. And Hyatt has a brand, you know, it's Marriott has a brand. These are, you know, appeal to the masses and it's, you know, less specific, but like it's a shorthand that stands for something. And I think it's also something that people will pay a premium for rather than, you know, a sort by price. And it's, you know, you're looking for a key feature or benefit.
And that's fair. And I would definitely say that TED has benefited by having that label. It does work as a shorthand. So in all the noise online, if someone's looking at, you know, here's two videos of a public talk, and one of them was a TED talk, just possibly because they think, oh, well, TED Talks, it's probably extra effort has gone into that one. I'll watch that one. I mean, that probably does benefit us significantly. And it certainly made it, the reason why TEDx has worked is that TEDx organizers have found it easier to recruit both speakers and audiences just because of the shorthand of that label.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So have you always thought about generosity the way you do now? Like back when you were running your $400 million business, were you generous? How have things changed and when did they change?
I think I've often thought of generosity with a bit of guilt that I wasn't doing enough. You know, my parents were missionaries. They. I don't share their religious beliefs now, but their commitment to living for something bigger than they were, it was deeply inspiring. Deeply inspiring. They lived that every day. They lived lives of love and they cared for people deeply. And I was. Part of me was exhausted by it. It's like I can't. You know, like I want to live my life and have fun and do things, but it's been nagging away in there my whole life. So you know, I set up this foundation when I was building the company. What my parents were interested in were how many people are you employing. They weren't that delighted by the fact that I was sharing video game magazines with thousands of teenagers and young adults. But employees, you're giving people work. That's got dignity attached to it. That's wonderful. So a lot of my, you know, sort of self-worth was attached to that, which is especially why I had to fire half of them. That was agony. But I felt in my head was that one day there's going to be enough money in a foundation and I will figure out what to do with it. And so, you know, I put money in but I'd never really found the thing. The question I was asking myself was, how do you get most leverage on this money? What creates leverage? Like, if you just give it away, it's gone, but can you use it to build something? And so I think, you know, what does create leverage? I mean, I knew that technology could. I knew that entrepreneurship could. I knew that education could. I knew that design could. If you spend money on a redesigning something and then it explodes, that's but nothing really popped. And so what was so exciting about TED was, holy cow, ideas. Like ideas amplified. And a little pattern of atoms can wriggle its way from one speaker into someone else's mind and change their life forever. That's freaking leverage on board. And so it felt, so there was for me a beautiful aha moment. But no, I tried to be kind to people and whatever. And I would have said it was a high value, but I don't think I was living it. And I actually worry, and I talk about this a bit in the book, I worry that feeling of possible guilt pulls people away from even embracing the topic at all. I think the feeling is, Tom, if anyone here feels this, I'd actually love you to show a hand. Like, has there ever been a worry that just the act of starting to go on a generosity journey, I may be opening myself up to unlimited obligation? You know, like there is, does anyone feel that? Like, yeah, see, so Peter Singer, you know, has made it clear to us, you know, there's a child on the other side of the world who morally and philosophically is the same as the child drowning in a pond that you're walking by. Of course you run into the pond, pull the child out. Why the hell aren't you writing a check for the child on the other side of the world? What's wrong with you?
Right.
You're in the internet age. And so that part is scary. And so I've tried to figure out a way of what to do with that guilt, and how, and I've got an argument in the book that is satisfying to me, that basically says this is how we could together think about what our obligations are and also what the limits of them are. It's like how to commit to an ambitious amount of philanthropic giving, but not an infinite amount. Most of your money should be for you. But the key to the argument is that when you do the math, there's enough money in the world. If people made a reasonable pledge to do all that philanthropy possibly could do, and some people may argue that I'm very, very excited by this argument. And if you buy this book, I really urge you to at least get to that chapter. It's called the Pledge That Could Change Everything. It was written partly to assuage my own guilt.
Mm-hmm. Talk about that case study. You talk about Jimmy Donaldson's, Mr. Beast's, the eye surgery video. And I've debated this as well, you know, whether this is detrimental to his brand or whether it's a good thing to use people who he's helped as props. You know, are they being exploited? Is it good? Is it bad? Talk about that a little bit. I think it's a very interesting case study.
Right.
And I think it's worth exploring because you're right. We all grapple with, okay, so you've just given that person who doesn't have a home a sandwich. What about tomorrow? What about the next day? And the next day, it's like,
yeah, you're not addressing the underlying problem.
Yeah.
So this is huge. This is huge. I mean, we're in an age of cynicism, and possibly whether it's because of the guilt they themselves are worried about feeling or not, many people's response to stories of generosity is to poke back and to say, really, you know, did they really do that of the kindness of their heart?
You did it for the money. You did it for the views.
They did it, yeah. Or yeah, in his case, or in the case of some rich donor, they're just greenwashing their reputation. And by the way, where did they make that money? It was just through exploitation. Like, we will find anything we can to poke at people's motivation and whether or not that really was generosity.
Yeah.
And
does it matter though?
It matters hugely that people do that because it is creating huge friction on how kind we're all capable of being. We're afraid of doing it because we're afraid of opening ourselves up to that kind of cynicism. I think the correct question to ask is not to look for the bad in people's motivations, is to look for the good. If there is a bit of good motivation in there, as far as I'm concerned, that is generosity, and we should celebrate it. And we should celebrate the fact that we're in an era where there are multiple additional reasons to be generous, like that it can be in your long-term business interest and your long-term happiness, for that matter. So, Mr. Beast, there are people on social media who I think are doing it the wrong way. You know, there's a woman who was, you know, given a bunch of flowers, filmed. She shed a tear, millions of views. She felt really violated by the video and spoke about it and said, these guys didn't, you know, they were just doing it, you know, for that. They didn't ask my permission. I feel violated about it. So question one, have you talked to the people who are actually in Mr. Beast videos? They, by and large, are incredibly happy at the experience, incredibly happy.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how their eye got healed or fixed. If they didn't have the resources, the end result's the same.
So I've talked to the man who runs his philanthropy, who's very inspiring and completely convinced that Jimmy is the real deal, and that, you know, he's doing it to give back. So there's that. And then, most importantly of all, hello, 200 million subscribers. I have talked to so many kids, you know, aged 8, 9, 10, 20, you know, whatever, who are inspired by him. You know, they laugh at him. They, you know, not all of his videos are about generosity, but they're all fun and upbeat. And, you know, he's mastered the art of what it takes for a video to go viral. But they're inspired by him.
Yeah.
So do we want people inspired by the possibility that there is a modern version of generosity that's actually really cool? Sign me up. And it was the fact that someone like Millard Merg was inspired by Mr. Beast, and look what he did, you know. So I think we have to reset our engine here. There's a chapter in the book called Imperfect Generosity, I think we need to embrace imperfect generosity. It's great that someone has additional motives to do good. Other, you know, so long as they had some part of it, and you can usually tell by talking with them, so long as part of it is motivated for the good, then it's great that they're doing it. And it is generosity.
Yeah.
Even if there's no motive that's actually good, it may still be good that they're doing it, just camera back. We don't have to call it generosity in that case.
Yeah.
But in most cases of generosity, there really is generosity there. And we would do so well in this culture to turn off the cynicism and find a way to actually amplify the good.
So let's do it collectively. Let's breathe in. And let's exhale and release the guilt that we might benefit from generosity, whether that's, you know, we get our name in the article, or we get our name etched on the building, or backslap, or, you know, whatever. It's okay to release that guilt and go ahead and be generous in spite of the fact that we could benefit as well. That's okay. Imperfect generosity is fine. The impact is what matters. Intention is what matters, right? And, you know, if it's a win-win, as they say, you know, so yeah. Be it.
There's one other benefit from that, Brian, which is that people, like, traditionally, we grade generosity purely on the intent, not on the results. And there's something beautiful about that, for sure. Like, if two people try and do something with the same level of earnestness, and they give an amount that costs them each the same, one is successful. In one, there's some tragedy and the act goes wrong. We still, you know, they're both as generous, and that's fine. But by embracing imperfect generosity, I think it encourages us to pay more attention to the prospects of actually getting good results from it. Instead of just the impulse act of generosity, oh, there's a disaster, I'm going to write a check to someone in need. You start to ask other questions like, well, how do we actually address this problem? And so I think you are encouraged ultimately to look at things like, how do we affect system change? Who are the organizations who are actually doing this the smart way?
And your book already influenced me. I was walking yesterday on 42nd Street. I don't remember. Maybe it was Fifth Avenue. I was walking down the street and I saw this man carrying this huge glass tabletop, and it was raining and it was wet. And he was clearly heading towards this door, and I was in a hurry to get someplace. And I was like, nope, I'm going to stop and I'm going to open this door for this guy because he's carrying this glass tabletop. It's wet. I can see him slipping. He has obviously got no hands to open the door. So I stopped and I opened the door for him. And just that simple act, he gave me the biggest, warmest smile. I don't even think he spoke English, to be honest. But like, we had this connection. It lasted for 3 or 4 seconds. And then I went on my way, and I'm sure he's forgotten about it by now, but it's like, I got kind of this warm feeling, and it was positive for me.
So this is it. It all starts with finding somehow a generosity mindset. It's that's the first piece of generosity, actually. It's to let yourself go to the place where you think, I am willing to direct some attention to other people.
Yeah.
Shockingly hard to do. You know, we're walking down the street, we're commuting, whatever, we're focused on our work. We've all got so many things in our email inbox, and we're stressed. And it's to stop and pay attention to someone else is uncomfortable, and it's hard, and there's a cost there. But that is the initial act of generosity. Whether it's writing a check, whatever form of generosity you're doing, volunteering, whatever, it all starts at some point with the shift from me to, oh, you know, I'm connected with other people. And the shocker is, and we don't know this in advance, the shocker is that you get payback from it. You often instant payback just by looking at someone.
Yeah.
You know, so many people do not feel seen. It's a profound act of generosity to let someone feel seen.
Yeah.
And I'm naturally terrible at it. I really am terrible at it. But when you do it, even at work, you have a meeting, just take a moment to look someone in the eyes and say, by the way, I just want to say, what, that thing you did last week, that was awesome. You're amazing. You can make someone's day like that. It costs you not that much. It makes their day. And this, by the way, is the beauty of generosity. in so many, in, I think in every circumstance, it is asymmetric. The cost to the giver is far less than the benefit to the receiver. Mm-hmm. You know, what you give someone a contact, right? You open, you say, okay, I can introduce you to that person. That costs you an email and possibly a little bit of discomfort or whatever. It might change their life. A rich person gives money to a less rich person. It costs them nothing, and it meant something to the other person. So you want a world with generosity because all boats rise.
Yeah.
All boats rise. You know, that rich person, what they're lacking is meaning and fulfillment in their life and happiness and recognition that they aren't evil. Generosity gives that to them. All boats rise.
And it's counterintuitive. Adam Grant gives this talk, you know, on givers and takers. I love that talk. And he, you know, he argues that it is better to give than to receive. He breaks it down. But it's counterintuitive. Sometimes, you know, we feel like, well, I don't know if you felt this way. I've definitely felt this way. It's like, all I do is give. I'm the most generous person in my family or in my company. Like, I'm a doormat at this point. You know, people are just wiping their feet on me because I'm always the giver and I'm never the receiver. And so I get to the point where I become cynical and it's like, well, I don't want to give anymore because I'm keeping score. It's like, well, I've given 10 times and they've given none times. And so then I'll cut it off. But inevitably, then I'm living small and I'm not benefiting. Talk about that.
I mean, look, it's a powerful feeling. When humans evolved feelings for generosity, as I think they did, some people here will believe that God put them there. That's fine to believe. But there is a very compelling scientific story now about how generosity can arise in, you know, in a Darwinian evolution. Genes are selfish, but the creatures they build don't have to be. And for that to happen, all that's needed really is that you have a species with memory and this fact that I already mentioned of asymmetry.
Yeah.
If I've killed an animal and I've got more meat than I can comfortably eat before it goes off, of course, I should give meat to someone else. It costs me very little. It may save their life. They will remember it, and may benefit later. So I mean, these things can take off in evolutionary situations. But what comes with it is this package of feelings that are closely associated. Fairness, like if that other person never gives anything back, he gets shunned, and rightly so because he's not, you know. And so every human culture hates freeloaders and cheaters. And will impose penalties on them. So it's and this comes to profound feelings we have. So it's not an unnatural feeling.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly what the right response is. I think it's probably to act on it and persuade people and just say, this feels unfair to me. Are you missing out on the joy that a little generosity could give to you?
Yeah.
Like there's multiple ways you could respond to it. But we all, it's never a simple thing. You know, we have all these other things going on in our heads at the same time. One of the biggest things we have going on in our heads, unfortunately, is this feeling of loss aversion. That is a very, very loud voice and makes it very hard to listen to the whisper of generosity sometimes. And,
yeah.
And it makes us, it blinds us to the fact of all the emotional upsides that there are if we go down the giving route.
Yeah, you talk about in the book a lot of these biases that we are, you know, just as humans we have, whether it's confirmation bias or, you know.
Negativity bias.
Negativity yeah. bias. I think there's 100 plus biases. And then we have the result is distortion. You know, we don't see reality. We don't see it the way it actually is. We see it through, you know, our own lens. Talk about the instinctive and reflective.
So much of our lives, I was brought up religious and I was brought to believe that all of life was a battle between the devil inside you and God. And, you know, you had to try and win that battle. And it actually weirdly made sense of a lot of situations when, you know, you're tempted to do dark stuff. Well, that's the devil. And so you've got to fight it and do it. We've let go of that. It's a kind of creepy picture, and so it's fine. But what's dangerous is I think we may have also let go of an important piece of psychology, which is that we are really complicated beings. We're evolved animals. And as Danny Kahneman framed it, you know, we've got these, at a minimum, we've got system one and system two thinking. System one is our fast, instinctive brains on which we mostly operate. We mostly kind of sleepwalk through life doing, you know, driven by these incredibly sophisticated and brilliant instincts that we have. A lot of them are very good, bring us a lot of joy and so forth, but they're powerful. And then we've got this reflective self, that more conscious self that reasons and thinks. That is the storytelling self. That is the self which on our deathbeds is going to say, well, am I proud of the life I lived? Yeah. That is the self which whispers ultimately in it to us, you know, you're a good person, or you're doing the right thing, or, you know, come on, you know, it's, and so much of life, and I wish this was more deeply implanted in our education systems. So much of life is how you give power to your reflective self. Yes. Over your instinctive self. How do you do that? So obvious things depend on that, like, you know, diet and exercise and procrastination, productivity, all these things. You know we're in these constant battles where we sometimes hate ourselves for not doing it right. And we work out all these life hacks to get around it.
Well, you talk about the instinctive self as, you know, it's called the lizard brain, or, you know, you have it in your, is it the prefrontal cortex, the amygdala?
No, but the prefrontal cortex is mostly the reflective self, but the amygdala is...
The amygdala is where the lizard brain is happening.
Sure.
And it's the same reason, you know, I will continue to reach for a donut, or, you know, I'll have this algorithm where it's like I crave French fries and I know that I shouldn't have them, but...
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think So one way in which I apply that framework is that I think this explains to a huge degree what's gone wrong online and social media. I know a lot of the people who work for all the big companies, they're not evil people. They did not plan to create a system that would enslave us all to these demonic voices and, you know, drive us into different tribes and create all this fear and disgust. They did not. What they did was that they gave all this power to, quote, user choice. Like, we're going to create these algorithms that will amplify what people click on and do and say that they like, because, you know, we want their attention. Obviously, if they attend to something, they must like it. So dial it up. And hey, we can sell a lot of ads on the back off the back of that. What they forgot, I think it's based on a naive view of human nature. What they forgot is that user they were talking to was our lizard brains. It's our lizard brains that control our doom scrolling behavior.
Well, it's the dopamine
and
hit, right?
It's the dopamine hit, and it's it feels good. It feels good.
Not always. you have the FOMO, or you have
That's right. But our reflective minds are left out of it.
Yeah.
There was one for me really hopeful moment. Whatever you make of Elon Musk, there was one very hopeful moment early on in his takeover of Twitter, now X, where he said, the goal for Twitter is going to be to maximize unregretted user minutes. Now, I think that if he was serious about that, it's not yet clear whether he is, but if he was serious about that, that is profound and huge, because regret is a function of the reflective mind. And if we could maximize in our reflective minds, in our reflective selves, we would go online and we would be different people. We would amplify different things, and so I think is the right at the heart of how to fix the mess online now. It's to empower our reflective selves. That there is good in so many humans. There is so much actually beautiful stuff that is happening online and that's being shared. It's just slightly getting drowned out by the other voices. That is a fixable problem, and I think that is the framing to which to think about it. It's and there's a bunch of design things the platforms could do. There's a bunch of things that we can do, like to consciously curate your social media feeds, you can it can be dramatically different what happens. And even just to slow down and to take a moment to write a helpful comment to someone or to amplify someone who's trying to do the right thing, all of that is good. But it also applies in other forms of generosity, Brian, in terms of how, like, certainly in how we spend money. I think right now a lot of that is honestly lizard brain driven. You know, you see, lizard brain can bring beautiful things with it. Lizard brain drives empathy. You know, like the first, you see someone suffering, you cry, you text your $100 or whatever. But at some point you want to reflect and say, no, I've got these resources. Over the course of a year, what am I going to do with them? You know, how am I going to use them most wisely? And so I think that is the way to think about it. My path to generosity depends on recruiting, spending time reflectively thinking about this and perhaps teaming up with others. Team up, you know, invite a group of friends around and dream about what you could do together, maybe just locally or in some cause that you care about or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Just you take that time.
You talked in the book about these dinner parties that you and Jacqueline would host. I mean, the whole book is really a metaphor around how ideas spread. You use the word infectious. In this case, it's a positive connotation that, you know, these ideas or this positivity can spread. And I do think it's from the bottom up, from the middle out, from the top down. And it does start with small acts of kindness or positivity. I agree with you. I think there's more good in this world and in people in general. I mean, we are human beings. We have this, you know, yin and yang, this light side, this dark side. We're capable of terrible things. But at the same time, we have this reflective brain, this power to, you know, override the lizard brain and be more thoughtful, kind, optimistic. And the power is within us, right? And it just, if you think about how things amplify or there's this flywheel effect, you know, I love dogs. And so if I wanted to save more dogs, you know, if you think about 1,000 people in this room putting in $1,000, you know, 1,000 times 1,000, that's $1 million. You know, what could we do if we all sort of got in the same boat and started rowing together, right? The possibilities are endless. Like, we could.
It's to be a big boat if it's 1,000 people.
Yeah, fair enough. But you know, like if you think about, you know, how to solve these larger problems, whether it's to end homelessness or world hunger or any things that we individually care about, and it could just be in your little social circle, it really starts with you taking action and then affecting someone else. And then that generosity, it spreads because it is contagious. Like the smile is contagious. It happened to me at Wegmans, I think, yesterday. I was in there, you know, getting a couple of energy bars, and the gal who was ringing me up, she was sort of looking down, and obviously she's a little tired. And I said, "How are you doing?" And she looked up and her eyes, you know, got bright and she smiled and she said, "Oh, I'm pretty good. How are you?" I said, "I'm in from Los Angeles. It's a little rainy, but I love the city." Anyways, we had this little conversation, but it's infectious. It is contagious. And as we are agents of change, as we are part of the process, we can affect the change, you know, even if it's just a little bit at a time.
100%. 100%. I love that you had that conversation. And I love that, you know, generosity is... it's not just generosity that's wired in us. It's the instinct to respond to generosity. Mm-hmm. One of the catalysts for the book was that I got this inside view of a crazy social psychology experiment that we did in partnership with University of British Columbia, where a donor in the tech community wanted to give away a couple million bucks and did so in a crazy way. We called it the mystery experiment, where we invited people online to participate in something that might be stressful, life-changing, interesting, whatever.
Yeah, a bunch of people did. You put up barriers. You said,
this is... we wanted to, you know, have interesting people.
This might be terrible.
but they got an email saying, "Hey, we'd like to transfer $10,000 into your PayPal account. No strings attached." And they go, "Yeah, right." but when they took the money, the only string attached was that they had to spend it in 3 months and they had to tell us what they spent it on. But apart from that, nothing. Amazingly, I mean, I don't know what you would predict would happen there. Two-thirds of the money was spent generously. Two-thirds. Like, family, yes, friends, outside organizations, strangers. And the language, I had this incredible gift for me after this research got published, was to call back some of these people and say, what happened? And a typical story was, I got this money and I felt seen. I don't even understand actually how that happened, because they were, you know, anonymous donor and they just applied, but they felt seen and they wanted to make other people feel seen. And they, you know, so there was this overwhelming desire to respond to the generosity of the donors. Mm-hmm. And that impacted people, seven different countries, different income levels, happened again and again. It was truly amazing to see.
And you remarked that you don't know how that happened. My feeling when you said that is this idea that we don't know what any of us is going through at any given moment. It's like that idea of, you know, to, you know, be kind instead of judge, because everyone's going through something, right? And I'm guessing when you receive that $10,000, it's like, how did you know? Like, I couldn't make rent next week. And yeah, like, it's like, because we're all going through something, even right now in this room, at different levels, we're going through something terrible. We, you know, yeah, you can't escape the adversity.
Right? One woman who got the money in England said, okay, I'm gonna give this away in 2,500 $500 gifts or whatever, something like that. And made that plan. Next day, she had a tax bill basically for $10,000, so £8,000 or whatever. And she was like, but she stuck with it. She ended up giving it all away. And she told me, every day now when I walk to work, I get joy by passing the different people or businesses who I contributed to. Mm-hmm. And you hear these stories, you meet these people, and you realize that human beings are actually pretty wonderful. I mean, we're all so complicated, and there is nastiness out there. But the stories that are not being told are the stories of how wonderful we are. We have to find those stories. We have to find them. We have to live them. We have to tell them and share them.
So as we wrap things up here, I have to ask, some of your all-time favorite TED Talks. I mean, I have mine. I'm sure everyone has theirs.
I mean, look, I'm nerdy and I like talks that no one else likes. So I like, if there's anyone nerdy here, like David Deutsch is an incredible physicist who believes in the infinite reach of knowledge in the universe. I love him. Tim Urban's talk is fantastic if you haven't seen that. His talk on procrastination is so funny, but it's so relatable to something that we all need, you know. And he tells his own story of this difference between our reflective selves and our instinctive selves. He tells it much more wittily than I did, with beautiful cartoons so that's a fantastic talk.
I thought maybe you'd ask me what my favorite TED Talk
was. What is your favorite TED Talk?
Ah, thanks, Chris, for asking. I have several. I mean, obviously, I had the honor of meeting Sir Ken Robinson in person. I did a podcast with him. I think it might have been 2014. Don't quote me on that, but it's around that time. Hugely influential to me. That idea that dancers are just as valuable as mathematicians and scientists, that we need the arts as much as we need the sciences. And that's had a profound effect on the way I raising my children and the way I interact with other people and see people with different gifts. I also love, and I can't remember who gave the talk, but it was a talk, a woman who told, I think it's an old story from China, about this man on a horse who gets thrown. And the tagline is, good or bad, hard to say. And it's about how we see the world and, you know, how people saw the different circumstances of this man who was riding this horse, and he got thrown off the horse and he broke his leg. And everyone in the village said, oh, that's too bad. And he said, well, good or bad, hard to say, because he broke the leg, then he wasn't.
I don't know this talk. I think this is a TEDx talk.
It might
be. Which shows the power of TEDx. Could someone Google that talk, and we should share what that talk is.
Yeah, and I think you'll find it by Googling good or bad, hard to say. But the moral of the story is that, you know, it all depends on how we see things, because as he was thrown off the horse, then he broke the leg, then he wasn't enlisted into the army, and which may have saved his life. And then, of course, then people said, oh, well, it's such a good thing that you weren't enlisted in the army. And then it was like good or bad, hard to say. And so it's this lesson we get to choose the way that we see the world. I think it might be an old philosophy issue too, whether it's Socrates or one of those old thinkers is, we get to decide how we see. And it kind of goes back to these stories that we tell ourselves. That had an effect on me thinking about some of the stories that I'm holding on to that I don't want to hold on to any longer, and new stories that I want to tell myself about me and who I am, building, the person I want to become.
Speaking of Chinese wisdom, there's one Chinese saying that I have to share with you just right here because it's beautiful. So this is in give a talk making the case for how generosity leads to happiness. And the Chinese proverb is, if you want happiness for an hour, take a nap. For a day, go fishing. For a month, get married. It's a little cynical. For a year, inherit a fortune. For a lifetime, help somebody else.
I mean, we were just sitting back, chopping it up, reminiscing about the good old days and all that. tracking my roots.